And welcome to Midday's second hour as we continue our conversation with Delegate John Cardin, candidate for Attorney General of Maryland in the June 24th primary. So we were talking about water pollution in the Chesapeake Bay, and a lot of us, you know, wonder when is the bay going to get better after all these efforts, all these years. And you point to Pennsylvania, and that's it's a valid point. I hear it raised a lot by people who are opposed to the stormwater fee, the so-called ridiculed rain tax. They always those opponents of the stormwater fee always seem to bring up Pennsylvania and the Conowingo Sure. Dam and the Susquehanna River. So what are you saying? What are you saying with this? Are you saying, we're making adequate efforts in Maryland on the Chesapeake Bay? Now we need to look at Pennsylvania.
We have to do our part in Maryland, number one. And we need our partners, whether it be Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Virginia. Delaware has a slight part in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. New York has some Chesapeake Bay watershed.
What's your assessment of enforcement of the water the Clean Water Act in Maryland? What's your assessment?
And the stormwater management fee, which is how we are dealing with it. I will not only say that I supported this when it came out back, I think it was in 2012, maybe in 2011, but there was very little controversy over this bill. The only controversy was whether we were going to give the counties the ability to determine how to impose their fee or whether it was going to be a statewide imposition. And we decided to go with a less controversial way and let the counties determine it. Now everybody's complaining that people are being treated differently from county to county. Look, we have to enforce it because our bay depends on making sure that we have we are doing adequate
what do you think
regulation.
What do you think of the deals that were made for Carroll and Frederick County specifically? The Maryland Department of Environment went soft on them, some people say.
Well, it would be my goal as Attorney General to make sure that all the regulations are adequately enforced and to make sure that that all the counties are doing their part. And if they're not being treated equally, that could be both a private lawsuit, but it could be a suit or some sort of mediation by the Attorney General's office on behalf of the state. Because the fact of the matter is that the quality of the water is what's going to gauge whether, and we can determine the quality of the water coming in from each county. And that's what I would do as Attorney General. I would just monitor the situation and make sure that everybody's doing their part.
Let's go to the phone lines and take some questions for John Cardin from our listeners. Matt in Baltimore, we'll start with you. Go right ahead with your question, please.
Hi, okay. So my question for you is, from what I've read about your campaign, Mr. Cardin, it seems like the focus, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the focal point for you is like internet crime or cyber crime, things like that, and you concentrated on that in your time in the legislature. If that is, you know, the number one issue, according to you, or the focal point of your campaign, I'm just kind of curious why that in particular.
Thank you very much for the question. It's a good question. I'm running for Attorney General to keep Marylanders two steps ahead of the new threats facing our families without losing sight on those old and persistent issues that we face. It is clear to me after my work on Grace's Law, the toughest anti-cyberbullying legislation in the country, making Maryland a national leader on keeping our children safe on the internet, and revenge porn, cyber sexual harassment, which criminalizes putting somebody's naked image online, which has become a major problem in ruining people's lives at the click of a mouse, their reputations, their relationships with their families, their emotional status, and perhaps even suicidal tendencies. We need to focus on these next generation issues. My daughter's 2 years old. She already learned how to play music on my wife's iPhone and call her grandparents over Skype before she even learned how to walk. And so if we try and ignore the new threats and cyber crimes and cybersecurity, which is what the Attorney General's office in the coming years is going to be spending a tremendous amount of time and energy. I'll give you one other example, identity theft. This is an area of cybercrime that has reached momentous proportions. Every single person in the state of Maryland, according to statistic, has either somebody within one degree of separation who has been impacted by either identity theft or by somebody stealing their information, their personal information. We know what's happening in Target. We know what's happening at University of Maryland with people's identities being stolen and taken and used for nefarious purposes. And the Attorney General's office needs to coordinate with federal authorities, with the state police, with the local state's attorneys and the local police not only to reduce violent crime, which is what the National Association of Attorneys General makes clear is the number one way to do it, but also to deal with the new era of internet crime.
Another question from Bob in Chester or Chestertown. Bob, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. And it is Chester, not Chestertown.
Oh, Chester. Where is Chester?
It is on Kent Island.
Kent Island. Okay, thank you very much. Yep.
Kent Island is split into Stevensville and Chester.
Okay.
But what I was calling about is there is a TV ad that I've seen several times in which Mr. Frost is accused of spreading lies about Mr. Carden's family. And I'm curious to what specifically is being referred to in this ad. Thank you.
Sure. I'll give you a couple examples. And again, I have tremendous respect for my opponents. I think we get into the political world and we start to look at the end and not the means. And I think that suggesting that I somehow missed 75% of the work in Annapolis is dishonest, or I would say at least disingenuous. Let me say that. That I voted against Jessica's law is just false. I voted for Jessica's law.
Jessica's law, please explain for our listeners who don't know.
Jessica's law is a bill that would abolish parole for sexual offenders of people who commit sexual crimes against kids under the age of 13.
You were accused of voting against that?
Yes.
And you actually supported it?
I support that, and my opponent does not.
Okay. Do we cover what is stated in that ad?
I think that's
for
pretty
Bob?
Good.
Okay. Jeremy, calling from Bowie with a question for John Carden. Go right ahead, please.
Hey, guys. Thanks for your time. I'm glad you just brought up a couple of bills, because that's what my question is about. John, you've indicated after a little bit of a scandal about not showing up to vote on some bills, you indicated that no vote you missed was important, but you actually seemed to miss a lot of votes on bills that you yourself co-sponsored. So are we as voters and me as a student, am I to assume that those bills were unimportant to you?
No, I mean, I think the policies, it's fair questions. I think the policies are important. The bills are, I didn't suggest that the bills weren't important. The issue was if it's a unanimous vote and I have a choice between going home to handle the health concerns of a family member versus being in Annapolis late in the evening to vote on a bill that is voted 20 out of the committee 22-0 or 23-0, depending on whether I'm there or not, I made a decision. You can like it or dislike it, but that was what I did this year.
A question from Carol in Cecil County. I would like to know the candidate's position on gun control generally.
I supported the governor's bill on gun control last year. I think it was a good start. I put in a bill this year that would close the one gaping loophole in that bill, which permits people to receive guns if their background check is not done within the 7 days required by the law. We've released 364 guns to...
Yeah, we should explain that to people. Because sure. of all the rush to buy guns this past year,
the state police are the ones, and there's an attorney general who actually oversees the state police and
right.
could direct them to use the resources differently.
Gun dealers were actually selling guns.
You're required to do a background check. If you fail the background check, you're not permitted to have a gun.
Right.
The problem is that if the background check is not completed within 7 days by the state police, they're permitted to release the guns regardless of whether they pass or fail.
And what was the number that were
released? As of about 2 months ago, 364 guns had been released right by the end of session to people who did not qualify.
Who would have been ineligible.
And at least two of them have been used in commission of felonies.
Okay. Another question. Russell in Baltimore. Go right ahead with yours, please.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
So my question for Mr. Carden is, what is your general position on mandatory minimum sentencing and then specifically dealing with sexual assaults?
Sure. And I would ask you to try and call back next hour and see if you can ask my opponent that as well. I happen to be in look, we all have concerns with mandatory minimums for nonviolent drug offenders, for people who smoke dope or smoke crack or that kind of thing. But when it comes to an individual who rapes your son or your daughter, there ought to be some mandatory sentence. I don't care whether it's 24 hours. I don't care whether it's 2 days. You should be put in jail. As a criminal defense lawyer, people would say this is against my own interest to say this. But I believe that people who rape or somehow harass or torment our young children should be required to do a mandatory minimum sentence. I believe that my opponent does not agree with me on that.
Okay, so I'll ask Brian Frosch about that. Senator Frosch will be joining us in a few minutes for his two segments here in the second hour of Midday. Another question for John Cardin. This is Mike in Baltimore. Mike, you're up next. Go right ahead, please.
Hi, Mike. I'm very interested in what you plan on doing with drugs, with it seemingly people want to decriminalize marijuana, and drugs are such a bad problem in Maryland. Surrounding counties, heroin is terrible. You know, how you plan to address that?
Well, there was an opportunity to voice your opinion about decriminalization in this
sure.
past session of the House of Delegates. Yeah. So what happened?
This year I was not only fortunate enough to vote for the decriminalization of marijuana bill. Remember, we're not making it illegal with that. What we're doing is we're saying we're not going to send you to jail for smoking marijuana, because it not only is this an issue of resources, that we should be using our money, our finite resources, for violent offenders, for gang violence, for the illegal gun trade, for gangs trying to prey on individuals in prison and out of prison. We should not be putting people in jail for smoking dope. But there's also a civil rights issue. You are 3.1 times more likely to be locked up, arrested and locked up if you're an African-American male than if you're a white counterpart, even though you smoke dope in the exact same proportions. So this is a civil rights issue. I've been very much in favor of this. I drafted the amendment in the House that turned the decriminalization bill from a task force, which was how it was originally structured, into an actual bill. In terms of legalizing marijuana, we're not talking about legalizing drugs. Most of the other drugs are already available for prescription anyway. You got heroin type products and cocaine type products that are available in prescription form, and they should be handled in the same way that they're being handled right now. In terms of legalizing marijuana, we need to look at how the pitfalls that Colorado and Washington are seeing. We need to make sure that our young people are not taking advantage of this because of changes in policy, because it could have an impact on their emotional and psychological growth. We also have to make sure that we don't have people smoking dope who are driving more because of that.
Do you feel the legislature kicked the can down the road on the issue of bail review and representation of suspects, defendants in the bail review system?
Yeah, I think this is a difference between my opponent and I. The Richmond case determined that, and this is a court of appeals case, determined that every single defendant has a right of a lawyer at a bail review. My opponent proposed a bill that all the experts say would be a multi-million dollar scheme that would allow a computer to solely determine somebody's freedom or whether they stay in jail. Now, other states do, in fact, use computers, but no other state in the nation, no other jurisdiction in the entire country relies solely on a computer to determine somebody's freedom. That's un-American, it's Orwellian, and it is a limit to technology.
Well, we have court commissioners.
Right.
So how do you feel about our system? What do you think needs a change?
Well,
we're down to 1 minute.
Sure.
Now, so.
Okay, very quickly. I think that we need to what I proposed, and my amendment got a lot of flair, and it didn't pass. But my amendment would have allowed Rule 16 lawyers. We already got University of Maryland, University of Baltimore, and their law students, as well as their supervisors, to be available. They're adequate attorneys. They already deal with criminal laws and criminal legal actions, as well as many other major issues, and they're very good at it.
Are they lawyers?
They are, according to the law, they are Rule 16 lawyers.
These are probably law students.
Law students under the supervision of a supervisor.
Okay.
So we'd use them as well as panel attorneys. It would have saved us tens of millions of dollars relative to using a computer system. And we've already spoken about early in the show about how computers do have limits. We have great opportunities with computers, and we've talked about some of the limits and some of the opportunities. But if we can't even make sure that we can use a computer safely to vote, should we be using a computer solely to determine somebody's freedom? It's not just a civil right, it's a constitutional right that we need to make sure is protected.
And the last thing you'd like to say to voters
about your
candidacy?
Thank you very much, Dan. It's been an honor. I'm running to keep Marylanders two steps ahead of those new threats facing our families without losing sight of those old and persistent issues. I'm the only general practice attorney. I am an unapologetic Democrat, and I am one of the most pragmatic and progressive legislators in the General Assembly. I hope that I can earn your vote. I'm also the only candidate from the Baltimore area running for any statewide position whatsoever. Thank you.
State Delegate John Cardin from Baltimore County has been our guest here. We'll move on now to another candidate for Attorney General in Maryland. Senator Brian Frosch will be joining us in just a minute. Thank you, Delegate Cardin.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. It's Candidates Week here on WYPR. We've been interviewing candidates for governor the last couple of days. Today, candidates for attorney general in Maryland in the Democratic primary. We heard from Delegate Aisha Braveboy, Delegate John Cardin, and now Senator Brian Frosch, who's joining us here in Studio A from Montgomery County. Brian Frosch has been in the legislature quite a long time, 20 years, representing Montgomery County, and he's served as chairman of the Judicial Proceedings Committee for the last 11 years, and he's also a candidate for Attorney General. Brian Frosch, nice to have you on Midday. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
I gave a little bit of background there. Did you grow up in Maryland? Where'd you go to school? I asked those basic bio questions.
I'm a public school kid, Montgomery County, graduated from Walter Johnson High School.
And where'd you go to college?
Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
Uh-huh. And your law degree?
Columbia University in New York.
Okay. And in Maryland, when did you settle in Maryland then? You came back here
I've essentially lived here my whole life. I went away to school. I took a little sojourn to New Mexico for a couple of years to work on some international antitrust cases. But otherwise, I've lived in Maryland just about the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. And I ask this question also of every candidate, Republican or Democrat, what makes you one? What made you decide to be a Democrat way back whenever you made up your mind?
My parents were passionate about public policy. My dad was involved in the 1950s. He stood up to Joe McCarthy in the early 50s. He was on the Montgomery County Council from 1958 to 62, one of the prime movers behind the county's first public accommodations ordinance, first anti-discrimination ordinance, I think in the state as well. And it was watching his example that got me fired up.
And what about your mom?
My mom was an arts person. She founded a thing called Adventure Theater. It's a theater workshop for kids, and they put on plays, and that was how she spent her time raising my sisters and me.
And what made you decide to turn to the law?
You know, I was interested in public policy. My dad was a lawyer, and it seemed like a logical thing to do at the time. I went straight to law school from college, and I was very interested in it, but I never thought I'd end up practicing law. I wanted to work on Capitol Hill, which I did right after law school.
And those things go together a lot, don't they? Politics and the law. A lot of attorneys end up getting into public life, public service in some way, either the regulatory side or in elective office, such as you did, because of a general interest in civic life, in the law?
Yeah, I mean, if you care about public policy, it's all written down in the law. That's where you make it. Mm-hmm. And it's an extremely useful tool. You can be an effective legislator without being a lawyer, but it sure helps if you are a lawyer and can write the law and read the law.
You were in the House of Delegates first in Maryland.
I was.
And then in the Senate, you've been in the Senate how long?
20 years. This is my 20th.
20th years in the Senate.
Correct.
And before that in the House of Delegates.
For 8, right.
So 11 years as chairman of judicial proceedings, and maybe everyone in our audience knows what that is. But what happens on judicial proceedings? What kind of legislation do you see there?
So we have a broad range of jurisdiction. There are only 4 standing committees in the Senate, so there are only 4 committee chairs. And the Judicial Proceedings Committee has jurisdiction over civil rights, constitutional law, criminal law, lots of civil law. We got transportation, we got real estate, we got trusts and estates, we got corporate law, and on. So it's a very broad jurisdiction. Essentially, the issues that we deal with are the issues that are at the core of the responsibilities of the Attorney General.
And why running for Attorney General? Why doing that now?
Well, I've always wanted to make a difference. I mean, that's why I'm in public life. And I think I can make a greater difference on issues that matter to Marylanders and issues that I think are important as Attorney General than I can even as Chairman of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee.
Well, let me ask you this. What do you think of Doug Gansler's job? He's from Montgomery County, too. He's been Attorney General for 8 years. Now he's running for governor, obviously.
Right.
So what do you think of the job he's done generally? And what about where would you make improvements?
I think he's done a good job generally, and I think I could improve on it. I think first let me say I'm not running for any other job ever. This is it for me. I don't plan to run for governor. It's not going to be a stepping stone or a springboard to anything. I think that frees me up in a lot of ways that are valuable. I mean, the Attorney General is the chief legal officer of the state of Maryland, and it's not a political job. You have to run for it, but mm-hmm. your job is in large part to give wise counsel to the state and to represent the people of the state of Maryland. I say I'm running to be the people's lawyer, and that's why I say it. So the Attorney General can make a huge difference, can improve Marylanders' lives, and can help protect them. And that's why I'm running for the job.
So your experience has been mostly in the law as in practice. You've been a practicing attorney, right?
Yeah, I've been in private practice for more than 35 years.
Right. Okay. And then the House of Delegates, then the Senate, and in judicial proceedings.
Right.
And you're saying you've already had most of your career. You're building another part of it, but you're not looking to use it to run for governor in the future.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and so as Attorney General, I'm not going to have to look over my shoulder and worry about whether I'm going to anger some interest group or worry about where the next campaign contribution is coming from.
Right.
I think I'll be able to be a fair, impartial umpire, if you want to call it that, call balls and strikes fairly, and represent the people, period, without regard to what the political consequences might be.
You've heard this term used, proactive attorney general,
yeah,
versus what, the one who waits for assignments to give legal advice to the governor and the various state agencies,
right,
overseeing a pretty large law firm from St. Paul Street in Baltimore. So what do you think of when people say proactive attorney general? Is that the kind you would be, and what is that anyway?
Well, there are different parts of the job, and one of them is being the counsel to the state agencies. And to some extent, you have to be reacting to what your clients are asking you.
Right.
They say, hey, can we do this? Or how do we do that? And you've got to give them good counsel. So to a certain extent, I suppose you could argue that that's reactive. But being a good counsel is more than that. Being a good counsel is anticipating what their problems are going to be and telling them how to get out ahead of them. And I have a lot of experience doing that in private practice. I'm pretty sure I can apply it well in the office of the Attorney General. But there is another component of the job. The Attorney General defends the state when it gets sued and sues on behalf of the state. And those are the areas in which people talk about, you know, active attorneys general. You have to be reactive when you get sued, but an important part of the job is anticipating what might get you into trouble, mm-hmm, and trying to steer clear of it. So the defense aspect is not totally reactive either. And of course, the areas in which the Attorney General has the discretion to emphasize or to prosecute or to pursue certain goals is the area that has the highest profile in the public eye.
Right.
It's an extremely important part of the job, one that I am very anxious to take on.
What do you see on the horizon? Then if you're in that mode, anticipating legal challenges for the state, legal issues that may arise, what are you seeing in the future, in the immediate future?
Well, there are some that you can see today. If you look back at the subprime crisis, you can see echoes of that coming toward us. The Americans owe trillions of dollars to banks for credit card loans, student loans too. And many of the same problems that we stumbled into in the subprime crisis, we're facing in those areas as well. The banks, when they have, if you borrow or I borrow $1,000 from my bank and I get delinquent, after 180 days, they sell it off because it affects their lending limits. And when they sell it off, they sell it to debt buyers who pay 2 to 7 cents on the dollar for it. So if you owe $1,000, they're selling that debt for $20 or $50 or somewhere in that range. And the debt buyers pursue Maryland citizens. The banks get the debt buyers get these obligations without any warranties from the banks. They say, I don't know if Roderick really owes it to us or not, but here we got a spreadsheet that says he owes us $1,000. Go get him.
Mm-hmm.
They end up filing affidavits if they can't get it out of you over the phone or by banging on your door. They sue you and they file an affidavit saying he owes it to us. They don't know whether the debt's been discharged in bankruptcy, whether it's been paid down, whether the statute of limitations have run, but they file affidavits just as they did in the subprime crisis. And so we have Marylanders chased by folks to whom they may not owe money, from whom they never really borrowed the money.
And we're seeing that now, and that's something you anticipate we're going to see more of?
Yeah, it's happening right now. Mm-hmm. And when the economy turns down again, the problems are going to be enormous. So it's something the AG needs to get out in front of.
Senator Brian Frosch is our guest here on Midday. 28 years in the Maryland General Assembly, 11 of them as committee chairman of Judicial Proceedings Committee, and now a candidate for attorney general in the June 24th primary. 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join me in asking questions of the candidate in what remains of this hour of Midday. We'll go to Carolyn in Annapolis, who has a question for Senator Frosch. Go right ahead, Carolyn.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Senator Frosch. Could you talk about your legislative record about the environment and what you plan on doing on the environment as your attorney general?
Thanks for the question, Carolyn. I'm the author of many of Maryland's environmental laws, and I'll give you a couple examples. I'm the author of the Maryland Recycling Act. It's why most of us have to drag those bins out to the curb every week. But it means we recycle about 6 billion pounds of trash every year in Maryland. I'm also the author of the law that stopped the oil companies from drilling for oil and gas in the Chesapeake Bay, and the author of the Maryland Brownfields Act. That's the law that has resulted in the cleanup of thousands of acres of contaminated industrial sites and the redevelopment of those areas throughout the state. Sponsor of the laws that have banned dumping in the bay, increased fines and penalties for polluters and for people who steal state resources, and many, many, many others. And the attorney general is the person who enforces those laws, implements and enforces those laws. I think that gives me a bit of an edge because I've written many of them. I know where the bodies are buried. I know how to implement the Brownfields Act, how to make that work. I know where people are cutting corners, and I think I know the best strategies for cracking down on polluters and ensuring that we're protecting our waters and protecting our air as well.
Are we doing an adequate job of enforcement of the water quality laws?
Well, we could be doing better. Sadly, over the past 7 years, we've cut the budgets of virtually every state department. And just to give you an example, in the Department of Environment, the Water Management Administration, the caseloads of the inspectors in that department have tripled. They have now each have about 1,100 or 1,200 permittees that they are responsible for. And the permits allow an industry or a business to pollute. They say you can
up to a limit.
Up to a limit.
Right.
So much nitrogen, so much phosphorus, whatever it is, but here's your limit. Well, if the inspector has 1,200 of those and has to get around and do the water samples and look at the effluent and all that kind of stuff, they're not going to get there every year. They're not going to get there every 2 years, 3 years. Sometimes they don't get there more than every 5 or 6 years. And what I find that happens too often is that they get there. They find a violation and they say, okay, look, this is really bad. We're giving you a warning. Don't do it again. Well, that means you just got a permit to pollute for 10 years. I think that if somebody has a permit to pollute and they're violating it, they should be punished. And as far as I'm concerned, they'll get a warning, but it'll be the warning when I take office. And after that, if they're caught polluting, they're going to pay a penalty.
Have you thought about the state's approach to enforcing the stormwater fee legislation that came through, to the effort to curtail some of the stormwater that runs into the bay through the largest jurisdictions here in the state.
Right.
The legislature sort of eased up on a couple of the counties in terms of how they raise money for these programs. What did you think about all that?
Well, look, we've given the counties a lot of flexibility, and I think some have used it very wisely and some perhaps not so wisely. We're required to do that. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency has put us on a pollution diet. And the only way we're going to reduce pollution is to address it in every major area. And stormwater runoff is one of those major areas. So we have to insist that our local jurisdictions participate in cleaning up that stormwater runoff. And the state has to enforce the law if the counties aren't abiding by it. I'm hoping that it is not going to take legal action. I think persuasion is almost always the best way of accomplishing something like that. I'm pretty sure we can get there.
I want to ask you about this. One more question about water pollution in the Bay, because, you know, there's been so many years and efforts have been made to make the Bay cleaner and healthier, and it's frustrating to watch what's happened. You're sure you're aware a couple of years ago when the Environmental Law Clinic at the University of Maryland Law School went after Purdue and
right.
a farmer, a contractor farmer, a poultry farmer for Purdue on the Eastern Shore. The governor of Maryland criticized that action and wrote a letter to the dean of the law school pretty much saying back off, or he didn't think this was a wise use of that resource of the Environmental Law Clinic to go after a farmer on the Eastern Shore. Now, we love farmers. We eat the
right.
chicken that the farmers produce.
We do.
We're ambivalent maybe about some of this. It's it causes conflict in our thinking about what goes on here in Maryland. But agriculture is a big source of pollution in Maryland as well. And there's this general feeling that the political class in Maryland, the political structure, the infrastructure of politics in Maryland, politicians won't go after agriculture for its role in the pollution. So where are you on that, Brian Frosch, after all these years in,
right.
in the legislature and right. judicial proceedings?
Well, you know, as I said a minute ago, each sector of our state that causes pollution to the Bay has to help clean it up. And agriculture is a major role player there. I served on the Governor Glendening's Commission on Fisteria back in the 90s with Governor Harry Hughes, and we wrote, our recommendations were we have to address the runoff from farms, and it led to the nutrient management plans that farmers are now supposed to be implementing. Unfortunately, they haven't worked as well as they should have. So we need to be vigilant there, just as we have to be on stormwater runoff. I think Governor O'Malley has done a very good job on cleaning up the Bay in general. I disagreed with him about the lawsuit that was brought by the Environment Law Clinic. Ultimately, it was the judge decided that federal judge decided that it was not chicken manure but cow manure that was causing the pollution. Therefore, didn't have jurisdiction to address it. But it is a problem. We import pollutants, nitrogen and phosphorus, feed them to chickens, and then we have to deal with it at the other end, and we're not doing a good enough job.
Well, I use the word ambivalence or conflicted feelings about all this because, you know, we're still meat-eating, we eat poultry, right?
And,
and we know we have to support agriculture or else it goes away. And the other side of it is there's this pollution in the Bay that's not healthy.
Well, that's right, Dan. I mean, you know, the farmers aren't getting rich. They're doing that work because they love it and they love the land. It's a serious problem, and it's a delicate balance because the reason they're in business is because they're near their market. The fact that they are growing corn and soybeans that they can sell right next door to a place that's growing chickens is
right.
why they're there. The farmers in the Midwest have a real cost advantage over our farmers. The way that we make it up is because we're closer to the market. And we have to be careful that we don't put them out of business because we'd rather they were growing corn and soybeans than they were growing townhouses. So you have to keep all of those things in mind.
Senator Brian Frosch is our guest in this last segment of Midday today, our Candidates Week here. He's a candidate for Attorney General of Maryland in the Democratic primary. We welcome your questions for him, 410-662-8780. And don't forget, you can submit a question by email to midday@wypr.org, or go on my Facebook page, post a question there, or you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Dan Roderick's with Senator Brian Frosch, candidate for Attorney General in Maryland's Democratic primary, June 24th. So a couple of follow-up questions from our previous segment with Delegate John Cardin. He was asked about mandatory minimum sentencing for certain sex offenders, and suggested that you did not support mandatory minimums for certain offenses. Do you want to explain that for us?
Sure. I think mandatory minimums are not a good idea in general. And I mean, that's a view that is shared not just by me and a few Democrats in Maryland. The Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, thinks mandatory minimums are a problem. Republicans across the country, including Rand Paul, think mandatory minimums are a problem.
Most members of the judiciary?
Yeah. I mean, look, we hire the smartest people we can to be judges. We need to give them discretion. There's no one-size-fits-all justice. And you can't pound every square peg into some round mandatory minimum hole. There are offenses that make your hair stand on end, and people should go to jail. But we've got life sentences for many of them, and our judges are meeting out pretty serious time. I think mandatory minimums have contributed substantially, and so do most social scientists, to the problem that we have of mass incarceration in the United States.
What was the particular issue here when it came to sex offenders?
Oh, the we had a bill. We've had like six or seven different bills called Jessica's Law, and the first couple were 25-year mandatory minimum sentences based on a crime that was committed in Florida, and there had been no history of somebody in Maryland receiving a light sentence for anything like that, let alone any history at all of somebody committing a crime like that. And the sentence was either death, because the child in Florida was murdered, or life if it was rape. And it was I just didn't think it was necessary.
Didn't think it was necessary? Did you think it was political grandstanding?
Yeah, a good bit of it was. I think people were afraid of the issue, but
okay.
Yes.
The other thing that John Cardin brought up when I asked about reform of our bail system and representation at bail hearings in Maryland, and this question of using a computer program or a computer model to determine if someone who's arrested on a Friday in Baltimore for, I don't know, violation of the open container law or marijuana possession should be assessed to be a flight risk or something by a court commissioner versus possibly a computer model.
Yeah.
So would you sort that out for us a little bit, explain a little bit of it to our listeners, and then tell us where you are on
it. Yeah, I've heard John's characterization of this a couple of times, and it really is the comic book version of a serious, complex issue. We were put in a box by the Court of Appeals. It made two decisions on how we have to deal with people who are arrested and charged with crimes. And we are required, and I think it's completely appropriate, to provide counsel to those individuals. I put together, in the wake of the second Court of Appeals decision, I put together a work group. I mean, I called in state's attorneys, public defender, the heads of our local jails, the Department of Corrections and Public Safety, the governor's office, and we met, put our heads together, and came up with a solution that everyone in that group agreed with.
Let's say what the problem was. The problem was you had numerous thousands of people appearing at bail hearings before court commissioners, district court commissioners, who had no representation.
That's right. And so we solved this problem twice in Maryland. You get arrested, you get brought to jail, and you go in front of a district court commissioner. Now, this person is not a lawyer necessarily. Some of them are, but most of them are not. And that person says, okay, Dan, you look good to me. You're out. He looks at me and says, Brian, you look like trouble. I'm going to hold you over.
You're going to spend the weekend here, maybe see a judge on Monday afternoon.
Right. Right. And then, so if I don't get out, then I see a district court judge who makes the same determination all over again. And our court said wisely, look, if your liberty is at stake, you're entitled to counsel. That meant that we had to provide counsel twice. And what was proposed, and I was the sponsor of it, but it was an issue that everybody with a stake in it, I mean, prosecutors and defenders, the jailers and the jailed, the folks who were representing the people who were being arrested, all agreed was the right answer. And that was, let's reduce it down to one determination. Let's do a computerized risk assessment first. And based on that, if people are at the very low end of the scale, we can cut them loose.
They're not a flight risk.
They're not a flight risk, and they're not likely to offend when they're out on bond. And this is this tool has been tested over 1.5 million cases. I mean, they've gone. There have been some very serious scientific research done on this, and it shows that you can predict with greater accuracy than using this tool than human beings do, sitting there and staring at the folks, whether or not the person's going to reoffend or offend while he's out or she's out, or show up for their trial. So
you think that could work? You think you could cull through a number of cases and eliminate those
absolutely.
Where there's no risk and leave the others for assessment by a judge?
By a district court judge, absolutely. Right. Yeah. And there's lots of evidence to back that up. If I were constructing the system myself and unconstrained by what we have in place and by what the Court of Appeals told us to do, that's not the way I would do it. But that's what we were faced with, and all those folks agreed. And I can't tell you how extraordinary it is to have prosecutors and defenders both saying, this is the way to solve the problem.
Okay. Because this problem was going to cost the state of Maryland a lot of money, potentially.
It is costing us a lot of money, and you're not just seeing it in the fees that are being paid to the lawyers who are being hired to represent those folks. You're seeing it in the local jails where folks are getting backed up because it's going to take longer to process them.
John Cardin, Delegate Cardin, has made a sort of a focal point of his campaign, a focus on fighting cyber crimes, computer attacks, that he calls the law enforcement's issue of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And are you on that, too?
Well, I'm the sponsor of the law that gives the Attorney General the authority to prosecute identity theft. This was a number of years ago. I'm also the author of a Telephone Consumer Protection Act in Maryland that gives the Attorney General authority to prosecute those kinds of crimes that are perpetrated over the phone. And this year, I was the sponsor of legislation that created a specific category of crime. It's called rape by proxy. And if I can give you a 20-second
sure.
explanation.
Mm-hmm.
A woman, Angela Alsobrooks, the state's attorney from Prince George's County, came to me and said she had to prosecute a guy who posted an internet ad about his ex-wife. And posing as her, he said, come rape me. I like violent sex. And this woman had dozens of men coming, pounding on her door, expecting to have violent sex with her every day. And what State's Attorney Alsobrooks found was she was dealing with a series of crimes, misdemeanors, internet harassment that carried a 1-year sentence. And this woman's life was in danger. And we created a separate crime, made it a felony, and carries a 20-year sentence so that she was able to cobble together a good amount of time for this guy. But when that crime is perpetrated the next time, our prosecutors will have the tools that they need.
Let's go to the phone lines and take another question for Brian Frosch, candidate for Attorney General. Kenny in Baltimore, you're on Midday Next. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for your time. My name's Kenny Blackstreet. I'm from Baltimore. I was just wondering, Mr. Frosch, I hear your name and Mr. Cardin's name a whole bunch. I'm just wondering if you can give me a little bit why you think you're more qualified than your opponent.
Thank you, Kenny. Let me say two things. First, I've been practicing law for 35 years. I've been named by U.S. News and World Report as one of the best lawyers in America. So the Attorney General really has to have a vast amount of legal experience across many areas. I have that. I also have great success in the General Assembly leading on important issues. The Firearm Safety Act was one last year. Protecting victims of domestic violence was one this year. I'm the author of laws that protect consumers from cheats and frauds. I was the leader in reforming Maryland's foreclosure laws. We had the fastest foreclosure process in the United States of America. And that's a great thing if you're a bank, terrible thing if you're a homeowner. And I led through the General Assembly legislation that Governor O'Malley was the sponsor of that gives homeowners more notice, an opportunity to cure, and an opportunity to mediate with their lenders. So, I mean, I've got a record of achievement in the General Assembly and a knowledge of the laws of Maryland that I think is unmatched by either of my opponents as well.
Doug Gansler, the outgoing Attorney General, in one of his positions as a candidate for governor, has suggested eliminating the office of state prosecutor. This is the office that brought famously the trial, the case against former mayor of Baltimore, Sheila Dixon, and former Anne Arundel County Executive John Leopold. What do you think about the office of the state prosecutor?
Well, I think
would you keep it?
I would keep it, absolutely. I mean, I think General Gansler's point is that there is concurrent jurisdiction. There are three prosecutors that have the ability to bring these political cases, cases of political corruption, state's attorneys, attorney general, special prosecutor. But the fact is, the ones that have been brought in recent years have all been brought by the special prosecutor. And I think that's important. I think it's I think it's useful, and I think there's no need to eliminate it.
Okay. You answered my last question just then to Kenny. What makes you more qualified than the other two candidates, Aisha Brave Boy and John Cardin? It's mostly experience. I mean, it sounds like in a lot of cases you can say, if I'm enforcing this law, these are laws that I saw as a legislator
yeah.
and actually even sponsored some laws. Is that your main selling point here, Brian Frosch?
Well, that's a big part of it. I mean, yes, I have much greater experience, but judgment is a key component of being attorney general. You have to know when to press, when to compromise, when to prosecute. And I think John has failed that test repeatedly. And I'm not just, the missed votes, I think, are a very serious problem. You can't miss 75% of the votes in your committee and toss them off as unimportant. You can't use state resources, police resources, for your own entertainment. You shouldn't endorse people, promote people without knowing who they are. And that happened with this Mr. Ski Money, where
the rapper.
You're
referring to that, yeah.
Well, yeah, and it's not having his picture taken is not a big mistake, but saying follow this guy. If you look at this guy's Twitter feed or his Facebook page, he's saying horrible stuff about women. And I just think to be attorney general, you have to have judgment and discretion. And I've had a lot of time and experience and think I've developed it.
Senator Brian Frosch has been our guest in this last segment of Midday today, Midday Candidates Week. Senator Frosch, again, is a candidate for attorney general in the June 24th Maryland primary. Of course, early voting has already started in the state. But we thank you for being here today, Senator Frosch. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it, Dan.
Yeah, and thank you to the other candidates who joined us today. Tomorrow, Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown will be here, along with Larry Hogan, a Republican candidate for governor, as we continue our Midday Candidates Week. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.